psychological factors in a very broad and general way in the planning and in the conception of new communities in the North. Now, most of the activity of the Center to date has concentrated on an analysis of the overall problem and on the identification of the relevant questions. Insights acquired so far on the conditions of life that influence the quality of living in frontier towns have been gained mainly through a study of the limited literature, several opinion surveys of frontier communities, and through a symposium on resource frontier communities that was held at the University of Manitoba in December 1968, and the proceedings of which have been published. It is then against this background that a few of the social and psychological factors will be very generally considered. First, there is the question of community sponsorship and subsequent control. What are the comparative effects on the quality of human relationships in a town completely planned, owned, and controlled by the major company, as against a community in which government or other agencies also have a share in the ownership and provision of services? Casual observation houses, collects the rents, owns the stores, the matter of statuses and hierarchy extends apparently into all areas of life, causing quite a bit of trouble. This phenomenon is more fully analyzed in the Canadian Central Mortgage and Housing Corporation's publication, Single Enterprise Communities. And in this, the author observed as follows. Some of the resentment stems from the transference of the planned hierarchical system into the non-industrial life of the town site. In other words, a stratification which exists between layers of employees in the plant organization pyramid is carried across the bridge into the homes of the company employees. Social status on the community in the community corresponds closely to the position or job held by the employee in the industrial operation. All persons are rigidly classified according to the position the breadwinner holds with the company. The houses of the various classes of employees may be so arranged as to make the distinctions sharp and stark. Now, while the great white father rule of the town is seldom relished by either townfolk or company, there remains the hard question of alternatives. Reports from some of the new communities in British Columbia interior, where various levels of government developed the towns jointly with the principal industry, suggest that some of the socially disruptive features of the traditional town, as described above, have been considerably reduced. But as a matter of public policy, governments are understandably reluctant to commit large amounts of public money to the development of town sites based on exhaustible ore bodies, uncertain mineral markets, and on policies of international companies about which governments often have little or knowledge and less control. Further thought and research might then be directed to ways of reducing the problems referred to, either by some changes in the traditional procedures and practices of the company, or by devising conditions under which governments or other agencies could justify active involvement and thus relieve the total concentration of all services as it is now on the company. Some research in the area of community involvement in the local government of resource frontier communities is currently in progress. However, the problems relating to the involvement and participation of the residents in the decision-making process of one industry towns, and particularly those of staging and timing the democratizing process, that is the transferring of power and authority from the company to the electorate, remains a vital area of further study. And we have in our center a political scientist working on conceptual political models in one industry towns, trying to determine at what stages in the development local political processes can be introduced, and at which point the company will relinquish total authority. Another closely related question is that of involving the residents or future residents in the planning of their own community, wherever this is feasible. This is the big condition. It is obvious that in most instances, the identity of the residents will become known only after the planning and construction of the town is completed. But in those situations where it is possible, it would be interesting to learn how future residents could be meaningfully involved in the planning of their future hometown. The Department of Indian Affairs and Northern Development study of Inuvik by A.M. Irvin, who is at the conference here, it is noted that there is still, and I quote, there is still much indignation among the permanent residents of the Delta over the fact that they were not consulted to any great extent in the selection of the Inuvik site, nor in the actual planning of the town, end of quote. Now, again, how collaboration of this kind could be achieved to the mutual advantage of both the planner and the resident could again form the basis of a useful interdisciplinary research project involving the city planner and the sociologist or social psychologist. I'm not suggesting that it's feasible, but it is another sort of a psychological point in involvement of people. Professor Tananura of the Department of City Planning is currently investigating housing in resource frontier communities. This is the title of his project. And is considering in this initial year of his study on a wide range and is concentrating on a wide range of social, psychological, and economic factors that relate to the preferences and attitudes of northern residents concerning their housing. This is the focus of his study this year, the attitudes and preferences of a wide range of people in the northern communities. Thompson, Lynn Lake, and some of these in Manitoba were used as sample areas. While studies such as this one may produce valuable guidelines for the planner, they are not a substitute for the personal dialogue between planner and resident whenever this is feasible. There can remain no doubt that, especially of late, Canadians in the South as well as in the North are ever more vocally demanding active participation in the shaping of their environment, be it physical, political, social, or psychological. In his study, The Psychology of Northern Living, Dr. Mathiasen of Anthropology is investigating the psychological and biographical characteristics of people who live in northern settlements. He has hypothesized that a process of behavioral selection occurs in the gradual stabilization of population in these communities. Should Dr. Mathiasen discover that people who readily adapt to northern life are characterized by unique behavior patterns and psychological profiles, such information would, in all likelihood, be of interest to the planner. So it would seem, and here I might just say that my manager at Lynn Lake, for example, is himself convinced that young men from the prairie towns of Western Canada or from the rural isolated communities of the Maritimes somehow adjust better and stay longer in the mine than do young men from the city of Winnipeg. This comes out of his experience. However, this is not corroborated by the experience in northern Alberta town of Fort McMurray. The reverse seems to be the case. So there may be, or there may not be, something to be found in this area. Should Dr. Mathiasen discover that people who readily adapt to northern life are characterized by unique behavior patterns and psychological profiles, such information might be of interest to the planner. So it would seem would be the motivating force that either attracts or pushes people into remote communities. Why do people come into these communities? Do they move into a northern mining town to make a permanent family home? More likely, of course, to make fast money for a few years and then return south. Or some perhaps, and this is being talked about more than ever before, for some other reason, such as the lure of the romantic north coupled with a desire to escape the rat race of southern life. An article just recently published in the Imperial Oil Review on instant utopias in northern British Columbia towns leaves the impression that it's the lure into these communities, which are perfect utopias, which is bringing the people in. The answer to this question, if it were fully known, would probably influence the planning. This matter of motivation would influence the planning, which in turn determines monthly rental charges made to the occupants. Indications from Manitoba mining towns are that much frustration results when excessively high housing costs prevent the sufficiently rapid accumulation of savings for the short-term employee. On the other hand, the company needs to attract young families into these communities, and the quality of housing available is a major family consideration when deciding on such a move. Hence, the reasons why people move into northern communities and their likely length of stay would probably be a significant consideration in an overall community plan. Geographer John Arago is currently investigating certain aspects of this question in his study, An Examination of Selective Population and Labor Force Characteristics of Four Northern Mining Settlements with Particular Reference to Mobility. This study is attempting to examine both the volume and the direction of labor mobility on the one hand, and to relate these, where possible, to selected population characteristics of both the human and natural environment on the other. Information on the social description of northern residents, their length of stay and mobility patterns that Roger's study is acquiring, would appear also to represent useful background data for the planner of northern town sites. A few general references have so far been made to the likely usefulness of information on the social characteristics of future residents when conceiving a community plan. Some elaboration on this appears to be warranted. Included in the social characteristics referred to is information on the percentages of the population in the various social classes, marital statuses, age categories, occupations, income levels, educational achievement levels, and ethnic groups. Taken together, these characteristics reflect the preferences and general lifestyle of the people. City planning professor Tanimura referred to earlier has described resource frontier communities as having, quote, a special mix of population in terms of age structure, marital status, family size, occupation, disposable income, etc. In our view, he said, the recognition of this fact is essential to the successful housing policy. Past studies have shown that the housing attitude of a person is, by and large, determined by his marital and family status, that is, by the stage in his life cycle, by his social class, with all its implications in terms of income, occupation, and education, and by his cultural background. End of quote. Similarly, it would be reasonable to assume that these social factors would also influence the planning of schools, playgrounds and recreation, hospitals, professional and commercial services, and the overall town layout. The space allocated to playground facilities might reflect the higher proportion of young children that are likely to be found in most single industry towns. Similarly, provisions made for recreation and amusement might be influenced by the high proportion of single men likely to be found in such a setting, and by the energetic teenagers, neither of which have anywhere else to go to fill their leisure hours or to meet their wide range of social and recreational needs, year in and year out. Surveys in some new Manitoba communities suggest that the planning of recreational facilities, both in kind and in quantity, was inadequate and misdirected. For one thing, the planners had neglected to provide teenagers with a congenial town hangout, a favorite downtown meeting place, of which most unplanned towns usually have several, and which meets strong adolescent needs for informal primary group relationships. The modern residential and shopping center complex has not allowed for such a questionable amenity. And this has been a real complaint of some of the young kids in some new, perfectly designed northern Manitoba town sites. At night, there's the street, and that's all. There's no Harry's Cafe or whatever it is that where they can meet at night. And they miss it, and they've said so. To cite just one example, some new northern communities have found that the predominantly younger age structure of married couples had not been fully incorporated into the design of their hospital, as the obstetrical facilities were soon found to be grossly overtaxed while other sections were seldom used. These represent but a few examples of the usefulness of specific sociological data in the design of new communities. But apart from the rather straightforward matter of applying social specifications to the physical layout, the planner of northern communities would also be aided by having a sensitivity to how physical layout can influence human relationships, the quality of which are of greatest importance in small, isolated communities from which escape is frequently impossible. The planner can, for example, design the community so that either social integration or segregation could be maximally facilitated. Marvin Lippman, writing on social integration of communities in Habitat, says that, quote, "there is ample evidence to support the assumption that most people prefer to live among those who share a similar style of life. On the other hand, we are nowadays increasingly concerned about enlarging the range of opportunities for all of Canada's citizens to tend to view segregation, whether along racial, ethical, or socioeconomic lines, as something to be deplored, or something which it is possible to avoid through orderly development and planning of our community and resources. Thus, the possibility of planning for greater social integration, if we desire to do so, seems greater at this time." End of quote. The question comes down to whether the housing for management, supervisory staff, service personnel, laborers, be they married or single, and native people, will be neatly clustered in isolated units and hierarchically arranged in the town site, or whether there will be an attempt to mix these housing categories through the residential area and thereby encourage the integration rather than segregation of the social fabric. Other writers have suggested that the reduction of social distance in isolated communities could be facilitated also by planning adequately for diversity of recreational facilities that would attract participants from all social groups. While isolation and boredom may be the two most significant problems of a psychological nature that face the designer of far northern communities, the scope of this paper is such that it can do little more than acknowledge their importance. The scientist, and doubtless the planner too, would like to know precisely what are the factors within an isolated situation that so frequently lead to boredom and ultimately, in some instances possibly, to psychological depression. Much research on human isolation has, of course, been carried out by the U.S. Space Agency, but whether or not findings from these studies can in any way be applied by designers to northern communities still needs to be determined. The National Science Foundation Office of Antarctic Programs has also carried out extensive psychological and psychiatric research on human isolation in the course of its South Polar studies, but these also, to my knowledge, have not been carefully studied to determine their applicability to the communities of the Canadian North. Now, as mentioned earlier, Dr. Mathiasen's study on the psychology of northern living is approaching the problem from the standpoint of personality type, with a view to discovering the personality profile of the individual likely to adjust well to the northern milieu, and then to develop an instrument by which such persons can be identified through a screening process. While the usefulness of such an instrument when recruiting northern personnel is readily apparent, this study was not designed to answer the more basic questions surrounding the potentially pathological effects of human isolation and boredom, some of which could conceivably be influenced by the planner. While ready and low-cost accessibility to and communications with the outside world appear to be obvious solutions, the economic realities of such communities are often such that only minimal services of this nature can be provided in remote communities. The Morrow Royal Commission report on northern transportation, which was recently tabled in the Manitoba legislature, called for massive extensions of highway and air transportation networks in the Manitoba North. The report further called for, quote, "indirect compensation to the individual resident of the North for the burden imposed by high transport costs through revision of income tax legislation and regulations." So by income tax adjustment, possibly ease the isolation problem. The implementation of recommendations such as these, together with a gradual northward extension of live television, will doubtless ameliorate the problems of isolation and boredom in the areas so served. but many questions with possible planning implications still remain to be resolved. Now, one could go on in this way ad infinitum possibly and cite other social and psychological factors which might or might not bear upon the planning process, but with these observations, Mr. Chairman, I'll stop at this point.
Thank you, Professor Seaman. That was very well written and quite informational paper on the psychological influences. Our last paper, but certainly not the least, standpoint of the need for attention to is the effects of the environment on design considerations. And giving this paper is Colonel E.L. Hardin, District Engineer of the Alaska District Corps of Engineers, located in Anchorage, Alaska. Colonel Hardin.
Jennifer Cave asked me if I was cold, and I said, no, I sleep next. I think we're all here tonight on the premise that out of all of this economic happening that we've been hearing about today, somehow there's going to be a new model community in the North. But those of us who have worked in the North know that without planning, it won't be any better, perhaps, than the construction can. And by planning, I mean the type of broad-range planning that Mr. Seaman described in his paper. Now, the military has come to realize the need for this planning in military construction in the Army. Right now, we're trying to create an environment rather than to adapt conventional buildings to an existing environment. It hasn't always been this way. Initially, we were concerned with providing an operating facility and shelter for the operators. Then later, we added to improve the efficiency of the operation and to provide our people with a few amenities. But then we came to realize that we're in the Arctic to stay, that life is going to be is becoming increasingly complex. We need skilled professional people, and we need to cut down on the turnover of personnel. And as a result, we are trying to create an environment which is pleasing and satisfying to the people. Now, there are 53 military bases in Alaska. And since 1950, the Army Corps of Engineers has spent over $1 billion in constructing facilities at these bases, much of it above the Arctic Circle. My presentation will describe to you, I hope to give you some idea of the multidisciplined approach that is required in building these facilities, some of the problems we met, some of the solutions, and our efforts now to provide a satisfying environment. First problem, of course, is foundations, which is enormously complicated by seasonal frost and permafrost. Seasonal frost, we know that where there is a fine-grained material or a poorly drained material, that it expands when it freezes and it turns to a liquid when it thaws. And our inflexible rule in this is to remove it. In the Anchorage area, we have to go down about 8 feet. In Fairbanks, it's about 10 feet. Now, permafrost, we can't have an exhaustive discussion of that tonight. We certainly need two things, more time and another speaker. But certainly, we're all familiar with what permafrost is. It's and it requires a good deal of careful design before we can go into it. The general principle is that we try to keep the permafrost from thawing. Now, there are various ways of doing this. On the north slope, It was described this afternoon. You can put down about a 5-foot blanket of gravel, and this will suffice for a road or for an unheated structure. But for heated buildings, we have problems. Generally, the principle is to try to get the heat away from the ground into the atmosphere. And we provide a ventilated foundation. Now, in designing such a foundation, you have to be careful that the drifting snow doesn't clog your ventilator. Also, that the occupants don't decide that this crawl space is an excellent place to store all your gear, because your house will sink. A more reliable solution is the elevated foundation, which places it up, really up on posts, which are firmly anchored in the permafrost, and which we have a clear path for the heat to dissipate into the atmosphere. Finally, I have my first slide now. I will show you an example of one of our first efforts to provide an elevated foundation.
Could we have the lights off, please?
This picture of this building was built in the early 50s at Glen Allen. Now, Glen Allen is one of these places where we have a discontinued permafrost. Here the building was built with an elevated foundation that has natural ventilation underneath, and each of these posts consists of 3 railroad rails driven into the permafrost. Well, after a year, you can see one sank 13 inches. Our investigation showed that because of the mass of the steel that we had placed in that pier, that the heat was transmitted downward into the permafrost, causing it to melt and the foundation to fail. We came to learn that any foundation design must consider the heat flow problem. A very ingenious solution to the heat flow problem are these refrigerated piles. There are 2 types. One, the condensation cycle, and the liquid convection. Here we have a refrigerant in the bottom of a sealed steel pile. Any heat that would tend to melt the permafrost causes this refrigerant to evaporate. And then the heated vapors rise to the top, where the heat is in turn dissipated into the atmosphere. Over here we have a non-viscous liquid such as gasoline. Again, the heat heats the molecules, which move by convection to the top, where the heat is dissipated. Both of these piles are capable of supercooling the permafrost during the winter to provide an additional margin of safety for the summer. Incidentally, this was designed by patented by Mr. Irwin Long of the Alaska Engineer District. Now, there is no one solution to the piling or foundation problem. In the early 50s, we built this test bed at Kotzebue, in which we tried out all the different types of foundations we could think of. And we have nearly 20 years of data now on the performance of these installations. This is one of our first buildings in Kotzebue, and you'll notice on this we place thermocouples down alongside each pile, and each year we go into there and on this junction box measure the temperatures to see the thermal performance of the foundation. So in this way we have learned. One of the low-cost solutions to the foundation problem was in fact. Here we scraped off the soil down to the permafrost, placed concrete footings and posts, then backfill. This timber frame building was able to withstand the small differential settlement that occurred. It is still standing perfect. Now, in the case of this antenna installation at Bethel, we could not tolerate a differential settlement. And the solution there was to drive steel H-beams into the permafrost. Unfortunately, we were not able to penetrate the frozen ground very deeply, and there was some concern that during the freezing and thawing of the active zone, that is the top layers of soil, that the heaving action would also raise the plowing up out of the ground. So the plows were then coated with a layer, a mixture of oil and wax, and we've had no frost jacking problems with those. Going to turn again to Glen Allen. This is one of the refrigerated piles, one of the first ones installed in 1960. It has been supporting this antenna ever since. The only maintenance required is an annual inspection with a possible addition of refrigerant. The refrigerant in this case is simply propane. I have generalized on the foundation problem, and that's the worst thing you can do. Our experience is that every foundation requires careful field investigation and design by an experienced foundation engineer. Now, closely related to the ground, of course, are the problems of water supply and waste disposal. In the yard, we expect that the requirement for fresh water will be from 80 to 90% of that experienced elsewhere. Despite the abundance of water in Alaska, this is not going to be easy to accomplish on the North Slope. This picture was made at Cape Lizard. We are able to draw the water from a well at 40 degrees and place it in these insulated tanks. We have coils inside so that heat can be added as necessary. However, because of the excellent insulation that has been installed, we find little extra heat is required. Now, this is a very expensive solution to the problem and certainly would not work for a large community.